You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
I think we're live. So thanks so much to everyone for joining us today for this, for a discussion of a really tremendously urgent and important issue of court reform. We've actually been thinking about getting this panel together over a number of months. And there's been always been sort of some unknown piece of the puzzle. Was the Senate actually going to confirm a new Supreme Court justice in the week before a presidential election? Who was going to win the presidential election? Which party would have control of the Senate following the Georgia runoffs? So there's always sort of been some other piece we needed to know. And now January 25th, we're here, sort of the core pieces are in place and sort of the big answer sort of looms, what happens from here? And so we've assembled a really tremendously knowledgeable group of speakers today to discuss these really important issues. A note to everybody watching, you can submit questions for speakers either by emailing events@brookings.edu or via Twitter at brookings.gov, all one word, or by using the hashtag court reforms. So as I mentioned, we have a really remarkable panel today, and we're especially fortunate to have Eric Holder, the former Attorney General of the United States and now a partner at Covington & Burling, who's here to deliver opening remarks. Both in his time in government and since leaving office, Attorney General Holder has been a leading voice on matters of essential issues of democracy, including fair redistricting, voting rights, and of course, court reform. Immediately following Attorney General Holder's keynote remarks, we're going to move into a panel discussion with Daniel Epps, Professor of Law at the Washington University in St. Louis School of Law, Marin Levy, the Professor of Law at Duke University School of Law, Christopher Kang, Co-Founder and Chief Counsel of Demand Justice, and Molly Reynolds, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. And I'm Susan Hennessy, and I'm also a Senior Fellow here at the Brookings Institution. So with that, I will turn it over to Attorney General Holder to deliver some keynote remarks.
All right. Well, thank you, Susan, for that that kind introduction. You know, let me start by stating three realities that I think should undergird the discussion today. First, it is painfully clear, at least to me, that Democrats and progressives are and have been uncomfortable with the acquisition and the use of power. Republicans and conservatives never have been. Second, let us be mindful of history. The courts in general, and the Supreme Court in particular, have been very political bodies, used as vessels for political expression and societal control throughout the history of this nation. Judges do way more than call balls and strikes. Third, except for limited periods of time and in a limited number of cases, the Supreme Court has tended to defend the status quo, sometimes in a way that is inimical to our founding ideals. You know, as we enter the beginning of the Biden administration, I think we should be frank about where we are right now. Our country badly needs reforms to restore balance and to maintain trust in our judicial system. What Republicans have done over the past few years is create an unjust imbalance across the federal judiciary. Their actions have sowed doubt about the independence of every level of the federal courts, but it has felt most acutely on the Supreme Court. Now, as all of you know, Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans created from thin air a new standard on judicial nominations as justification for blocking a vote on Merrick Garland. For more than a year, they reduced the number of justices on the court to 8, simply because it suited their political needs in that moment. Of course, just a few years later, they walked back their phony justification for blocking Merrick Garland to rush through the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett in the middle of an election in which they lost control of the presidency and the Senate. There was no principle behind these decisions. What they did was purely a partisan maneuver to lock in conservative control of the court. They used the power that they had. We've already felt the ramifications of these decisions. Now, I understand that people focus on the mechanics of how Republicans blocked Judge Garland, but we don't pay sufficient attention to what that has meant legally. If Merrick Garland had been on the court instead of Neil Gorsuch, there would have been a progressive majority on the court for at least 4 years. Some of the important 5-4 status quo protecting decisions made during the Trump administration could easily have gone the other way. There might not have been a Muslim ban or the Janus decision or the enormously harmful ruling in Rusko versus Common Cause, in which the conservative majority found that gerrymandering hurts voting rights, but federal courts should do nothing to stop it. As Professor Levy has written, you know, the Republicans who decry court reform at the federal level ignore what Republicans are doing at the state level. In 2016, state legislatures in Georgia and Arizona passed laws that not only expanded their state Supreme Courts, Republicans expanded their state Supreme Courts, but also gave the Republican governors the ability to appoint those new judges. As we meet here today, Republicans in the Pennsylvania legislature are pushing forward on a proposal to gerrymander judicial districts for their state Supreme Court. Now, they may not openly admit this, but they're clearly pushing forward this pretty brazen proposal because they're upset with what a progressive court has done and not always ruled in their favor of their conservative agenda. For example, in 2018, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturned a congressional map that was one of the most egregious partisan gerrymanders in the country. They are using, again, Republicans, again, are using the power that they have. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that Democrats and progressives should, you know, follow down the same path as Republicans. What they have done is abuse their power to give themselves an unfair advantage. But what I am saying is that Republican conduct deserves a response, a measured response that prioritizes the long-term health of our representative democracy and the independence of the judiciary. Democrats and progressives must use the power that they now have. I'm also not saying that pushing forward on court reform is going to be easy, but it is necessary. Now, as I've said in the past, I believe it would be totally appropriate to add additional seats to the Supreme Court in response to what has transpired over the past few years. I note that the last time seats were added to the Supreme Court, it was to match the expansion of circuit courts, which at the time had grown to 9. Today, there are 13 circuit courts. Now, I know the panelists today will be discussing a range of proposals that go beyond the expansion of the Supreme Court, so I thought it might be helpful to detail very quickly just a few that I think are worthy of consideration. The first is term limits. I think it's long past time for term limits for judges and justices at all levels. 18 years, 3 Senate terms, I think is long enough for those serving on the bench. A person sitting for life in an unelected position should not have that much power for that long. And a recent poll showed that 72% of Americans favored Supreme Court term limits. And we simply can't keep going through this cycle of allowing a death on the court to create chaos or leave the balance of the court to the whims of partisan justices who decide when the time is right to retire. It's just not tenable in the long term. So term limits and a structured appointment process where there is a timetable for the justice's appointment and replacement on the court, I think would provide stability and a level of fairness to the process that does not now currently exist. Second, we need to expand the number of judges on the lower courts. Far too many cases take far too long to work their way through the district and appellate courts. My hope is that the President's Commission will study just how great the need is and then recommend an expansion of judges based on that analysis. Third, I'd also consider adding a minimum age requirement of 50. Now, I do not suggest an age requirement lightly. I was 37 years old when President Reagan appointed me to serve on the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. And I think I was a pretty good judge. I would have been a better one at 50. Given the unique responsibilities the judges have, I generally don't think that anyone below 50 has sufficient life experience to bring to the life-altering decisions that judges are frequently called upon to make. And finally, we need to ensure that there is diversity on the bench. That includes race, gender, as well as professional experience. There is no reason that in 2021 we should have a federal judiciary that does not reflect the diversity of the American people or the breadth of experiences that lawyers across our profession can bring to the bench. A diverse bench is a better bench. Now, I'm not naive about the current political climate here in Washington. I know that court reform may not be easy, but these, I think, are important steps. I think they're necessary steps that ought to be taken. What Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans have done to the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary as a whole has created a crisis of legitimacy. The American people should not be forced to accept a court system that has been stacked with ideologues who consistently reach rulings based on their stunted mindsets with little regard for the real-world impact of those decisions. What I want, and what I know all of you want, is to restore balance and fairness to our court system. These ideas, adding justices and judges, creating term limits, creating an age requirement, I think would help get the federal judiciary working the way it was intended to and the way it should. They are not by any means the only ideas worthy of consideration. I'm sure we'll hear many more discussed in the panel, but I think they're at least a helpful starting point for a conversation about policies that can and should be implemented. So again, thank you for inviting me to join you today. Thank you for advancing this cause and shedding a light on reform that can and should be implemented in the months and in the years ahead. Susan, I'll turn it back to you. And Susan, I think you're muted.
I have to unmute the key. So thank you so much for those really fascinating and provocative responses. I think they comments, they give us a lot of rich fodder for the panel discussion. And we really appreciate you taking the time today. So with that, we will turn over to the panel. There's more issues on the table than we could possibly hope to cover in sort of the rest of the day if we spent all day talking about this, and we only have about 45 minutes before we get to audience questions at the end. So I'm gonna dive right in and start at a little bit of an unusual place, and that's the congressional and procedural reality. So I brought Molly here, my colleague at Brookings, sort of to be a ringer on this. A lot of the public conversation around court reforms is really happening at the political level and purely at the political level. And I think it's important to sort of ground these conversations in the basic procedural reality. And so, Molly, I'm hoping to sort of open the conversation by just having you walk us through at a basic level for the audience that's watching right now and might not be familiar, sort of the fundamentals of the current procedures, how justices are nominated and confirmed or not, as the case may be, to various judicial vacancies, and in particular, sort of the levers available to sort of move confirmations forward and hold them back. I think that's an important sort of place to level set as we have the rest of this conversation.
Sure, Susan. I appreciate the invitation to join you, and I'm happy to start us off by just talking a little bit about kind of how does the judicial confirmation process work? What's a little bit of the kind of relevant history, and why has confirmation become more difficult for nominees now than in the past? So a little bit to start about the stages of the process. So in the Senate, judicial nominees from district courts, circuit courts, and the Supreme Court go through the Senate Judiciary Committee. Once the committee has approved nominations, those need to be brought up on the floor. On the floor, they have been subject since 2013 at the lower court levels and since 2017 at the Supreme Court level to a simple majority threshold for cloture. So in the Senate, this is quite prominent in the headlines as we're having this conversation. Most legislation in the Senate requires 60 votes to cut off debate and move on to final passage. But for judicial nominees dating to, again, to 2013 for lower court nominees and to 2017 for Supreme Court nominees, you only need a simple majority to end debate and then move on to confirmation. Couple of kind of relevant historical things to keep in mind about this process is that since about the 1980s, I would argue, we've seen an expansion of the partisan conflict that really affects all parts of what Congress does into, particularly into the lower courts. We have lower success rates for nominees. So nominees are less likely to be confirmed. It takes more time to consider their nomination. We've also seen the erosion of several norms that have been associated with the judicial confirmation process in the Senate. Probably most prominently is something we call the blue slip, which is a tradition by which home state senators of the nominee for a lower court position kind of sign off on that nominee by returning what we call a blue slip. I think historically they were actually blue, but that's changed over time. And that norm has really eroded. In about 2017, Senator Chuck Grassley, who was then the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, stopped enforcing this norm for circuit court nominees. So we've really seen, even in previous years of high partisanship, we had still seen some deference to historic norms of the some bipartisanship in the nomination process. We've also importantly seen more and more filibusters of district court nominees. So Attorney General Holder mentioned the lower courts. I think we're going to talk about the lower courts, and that's really increased as well. So this notion that particularly before the shift in the threshold for confirming federal judges, or I should say for ending debate on their nominations, that we started to see more and more obstruction of even the lowest court nominees to the federal bench. Why has this all happened? It seems easy to point to political polarization as one of the causes for the increasing difficulty that the Senate has in working through the advice and consent process. But I would argue that that really is kind of the biggest explanation here. And it's certainly part of what helped drive the decision first by Democrats and then by Republicans to change the closure thresholds for ending debate on nominations. And then as we kind of dig in a little bit more to the meat, we'll also observe that my Brookings colleague, Sarah Binder, has done some work that's found that when we look at individual circuit court nominees, another factor in predicting why it's become more difficult to get them confirmed has to do with the partisan balance of the circuit they would be going into. So how many judges currently on those courts of appeals were nominated by each president. But again, just to sort of close, we have seen these kind of procedural changes in the process. They're consistent with broader changes that we've seen in the Senate for how the Senate does its work. But in the case of the court, in the case of judicial nominations, they've had, I think, especially far-reaching effects.
So Chris, Molly has sort of referenced this phenomenon that has occurred over the past several years of sort of it being more and more difficult to confirm judges. You handled judicial vacancies during the Obama administration. And as we're talking about court reforms and sort of the norms and cycles of normative violations, it's important to sort of have the context of how did we arrive at this moment, not just procedurally, but also sort of the politics and the hardball at issue. And so I'm hoping you can sort of give us your perspective on how did we get to this moment? And whenever we think about the substantive reforms we're going to talk about, sort of throughout this panel, are we talking about addressing imbalances that have accrued over the past 4 years? Or are we talking about addressing something, that has happened over a sort of a much longer period of history?
Thanks, Susan. I think at its base, we're trying to address the larger problem that Attorney General Holder noted, that Republicans are very comfortable wielding power and Democrats are not. And I think that that has in particular led to this asymmetry around our courts and how Republicans were the first ones to filibuster Democratic nominees to even district courts. How Republicans sought to block President Obama's nominees, not based on their records, but simply because President Obama had nominated him. That is what precipitated Democrats being forced to change the Senate rules in 2013 so that he could have judges confirmed to the DC Circuit. Senate Republicans did not raise concerns about the nominees' records, but simply did not want to lose the balance of power on that incredibly important court. And then you see here, again, as Molly noted, the Republicans throughout the blue slip process, 17 of President Trump's 54 circuit court judges were confirmed by breaking this longstanding tradition. Time after time, Republicans are willing to use their power, to wield their power, because they think they can, right? Their justification for confirming Justice Barrett just days before an election was there was nothing in the Constitution that prohibited it. And I think that that is what we really need to be thinking about when we think about what norms need to come back. I think once a norm is violated, it's no longer a norm again. You can't sort of wish it so. And I think as Democrats think about what reforms are necessary, that broad guideline has to be what follows them.
So Dan, Chris has mentioned sort of Republican obstructionism and explicitly political terms. Attorney General Holder mentioned sort of case outcomes, right? Sort of needing to rebalance the courts, in order to protect rights or achieve particular progressive policies. Sort of in your view, what what values are we trying to restore whenever we think about particular proposed reforms? You know, is this really just about sort of creating basic ideological balance, calling it for what it is, and saying we need to have the same number of conservatives and progressives on the court in order to be fair? Is it about some larger question of legitimacy? And you've been skeptical of sort of the pure court packing proposals and have proposed some variations. And so before we sort of tackle the substance of what reforms are good and bad, what should they be aimed at accomplishing in a really basic way?
Sure. And let me just say, that's a great question, because with respect to any given court reform proposal, I think it's really, really important to try to diagnose what exactly is the problem you see. And I think different reformers see different problems. Professor Stephen Calabresi, who's the co-founder of the Federalist Society, is a big advocate of term limits. I'm confident that he doesn't think that that's important because the courts are not progressive enough, but many other people share that view. One set of arguments I've made in my work that we could talk about a little bit is this idea that having the courts be this sort of locus of political contestation and actually something that helps determine the outcomes of political elections is destructive ultimately to this idea of legitimacy, this idea of the idea of the court as an institution that's somehow doing something different from politics. And so I am interested in reforms that would maybe get the court a little bit out of the political eye and also decrease the incentives for just appointing hardline ideologues on the court and have a court that's maybe a little bit more representative of public opinion. I mean, it is hard for me to escape that I have my own normative priors, and I don't agree with a lot of what the current court is doing. I think the court is too conservative. But I do think that I have been a little bit skeptical of straightforward court packing or court expansion proposals because of the possibility that they create this spiral in which we have a court that's sort of swinging wildly back and forth among ideology. I think term limits, which Attorney General Holder talked about, I think that they would definitely be an improvement, because I share some of the problems, the observations that that he made about the problems with strategic retirement. Nonetheless, I don't think, for me, it's not the perfect solution, because it still creates a world where the outcomes, individual cases and individual issues really, really rise and fall in the outcomes of particular presidential elections. And that creates incentives, for example, for Republicans to stick with Trump in the immediate run-up to the 2016 election, because they know that Roe versus Wade is all going to rise and fall depending on the outcome of this presidential election. And I think if we can think of ways to kind of get the court as a little bit outside of the focus of direct political contestation, that would be good. That said, I do think if we're not going to do that, it's better for Democrats to do that and be aware of it, to be aware of the court as sort of a locus of politics, rather than a world where it's just Republicans doing that and Democrats not doing that to the same degree.
And just to sort of ask a follow-up for you, Dan, I think there's a little bit of an irony that term limits, sort of one reform that does appear to have at least some bipartisan support, is potentially the most constitutionally fraught. Is that overstated? Is your view, no, there are plenty of sort of plainly constitutional options to impose term limits, and it's really just a question of sort of legislative will? Or, are there real questions about whether or not you could do this short of a constitutional amendment?
So, I mean, I tend to be someone who thinks there's a little bit more flexibility here than maybe the dominant wisdom is. I do think that there's workarounds, like having, the Supreme Court. One of the workarounds is the idea that you have new appointments every 2 years, and then the court that hears the sort of main bulk of the cases are the nine who have been appointed most recently. And so that would effectively create term limits, but you don't lose your position. You don't lose your salary. You go sit on the lower courts. I tend to think that there are very strong arguments for why that satisfies the underlying purposes of sort of the good behavior protections in Article 3. We've never conclusively resolved the fact that the idea that would be unconstitutional. And I tend to think there should be a lot more flexibility. That said, I do think it's a situation where the underlying politics are maybe going to dictate the constitutional law a little bit, because if you have a reform, even if it's a term limits reform, if it's ran through by Democrats on party line rules, you could imagine you know, a more conservative Supreme Court striking it down, refusing to follow it, something like that, where the sort of underlying politics are, this is seen as a partisan power grab. Whereas if we had everybody sort of come together and say, this is a good compromise, let's do this by statute, that it would be less likely. But it is odd that the, you know, and unfortunate probably that the most clearly constitutional reform is the one that a lot of people think would be most long-term problematic, which is just simple expansion by adding seats.
Yes, Marin, that's a good sort of segue to the question I have for you, which is obviously court packing, court expansion in some form is sort of the you know, proposed reform that's getting, I think, the most attention at the moment, and also getting sort of the most cause for alarm sort of across the ideological spectrum. It's not new, and you've written a lot about sort of the phenomenon of court packing and unpacking at the state court level. And so what is happening sort of at the state court level? And is it a cautionary tale that, you know, 5 years from now, we're going to have 97 Supreme Court justices if we take this first step? Or is it evidence that, you know, these concerns are overblown and actually the way court expansion plays out in practice is quite different than sort of what our initial expectations might be?
Sure. It's a great question. So the work that I've done, as you mentioned, looks specifically at the state courts. So it's, you know, in the fall, obviously, we started getting a lot of talk about court expansion, I think more than we've had in certainly in recent memory. And you saw a lot of Republicans coming out and saying, you know, this is certainly something that it should be off the table. And if you look a little bit more closely at what's happening at the state level, you can see that that's not the same approach that's been taken there. So if you look in the last decade in particular, that was the time period I focused on, we actually see lawmakers in 11 different states introducing at least 20 different bills, all aimed at expanding or contracting their courts of last resort. And in fact, as Eric Holder mentioned, two of those attempts were successful. So both Arizona and Georgia successfully expanded their state Supreme Courts. And over objections at the time that this was all, you know, we were seeing just court packing, that this was done specifically to shift the ideological composition of the courts. In terms of lessons for the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, I think those are a little bit difficult to tease out. Certainly, I think it gives us some evidence for the fact that the norm against court packing is not as strong as we might think it is. And I know we're talking about public opinion here. Certainly when we look at public support for court expansion at the Supreme Court, it's not as high as we see support for term limits, for example. That said, I think, you know, it may be an area where there's going to be some shift. Certainly as people become aware of the fact that our own US Supreme Court has changed size over time, I think that starts to change people's expectations. And I think if more people were aware of what was happening at the state court level, that would have a similar impact. It's also worth noting that oftentimes when folks are asked questions in these polls, they're presented with quite dramatic instances. So there was a report that came out, Adam Liptak reported on public support poll, noted only like 25% of folks were in favor of court expansion, but that was really substantial expansion. That would have been doubling the size of the Supreme Court. So I actually think that part of the lesson of what we're seeing in the state courts is there may be more support for at least more modest expansion than we might have thought before.
So Chris, I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I think you've sort of advocated for court expansion as being a necessary but maybe not sufficient reform, and that really expansion, you know, is kind of the single most important and promising path to walk down, you know, not just for ideological balance, but also for sort of diversity issues and elsewhere. And so I'm sort of curious, why is it that you think sort of court expansion is so important? And why sort of, if we couldn't marshal a sufficient coalition for term limits or other, you know, jurisdiction stripping, right, there's sort of lots of proposals out there, you know, why that isn't sort of enough to set us on the right path?
So I definitely think that court expansion has to be the cornerstone of any further reforms that happen. I think one, as Dan mentioned, this Supreme Court is going to determine what's constitutional in future, whether or not term limits are constitutional or jurisdiction stripping is constitutional. And I think that this imbalanced Supreme Court, this partisan political Supreme Court, has shown that it's going to handle these issues in a way that benefits them politically and ideologically. And so I think you have to start with adding seats to restore balance to the Supreme Court. One thing that Attorney General Holder said was he said that the Republican the Republican conduct with the Garland nomination and the Barrett nomination deserves a response. And I think that that's right. And I would go a step further to say that it demands a response. I think that Republicans have so politicized our court that it's lost its legitimacy. When we talk about what is the goal that we're trying to solve here, it's to restore legitimacy to the Supreme Court. You're starting to see polls come out that say that more Americans believe that the Supreme Court bases its decisions on politics rather than the law. That is corrosive to our democracy. The only way we're going to be able to change that is by restoring balance. When Democratic presidents have won the popular vote 7 out of the last 8 elections, and here we have a Supreme Court dominated 6-3 by ideological conservatives, that is not legitimate. The American public does not feel that it's legitimate, and we have to restore balance. After that, we can look at other reforms. We can look at reforms like adding term limits after we've restored balance, which I think would get to this idea of an escalating Supreme Court. You never don't have to add more seats in the future. You just have to win the next presidential election. And that's how you can restore balance. And so I think that if you pair those two reforms together, you can really go a long way in restoring balanced legitimacy to the court.
So, Maureen, sort of on a similar thread, is it foolish to overly focus on the Supreme Court? Obviously, sort of the confirmation and reform proposals and processes that have the most public visibility, or is it more promising to focus on lower courts, the district level, circuit courts, or are these things sort of all so intrinsically tied up that we've got to go and do all or nothing?
It's a great question. So I would say there is a very strong argument for focusing on the lower courts and in particular the courts of appeals, right? So one way to think about it is we of course know that the Supreme Court issues some of the most important decisions in the country on a regular basis, but I think we can overlook the import of the Court of Appeals, right? So while the Supreme Court is giving us opinions in 75 or so cases each year, remember the lower courts, the courts of appeals are issuing opinions in something like 55,000 cases. Right, so for tens of thousands of litigants every year, the courts of appeals are effectively their court of last resort. Right, so they're incredibly important. And I think if we focus on those courts just for a minute, right, it's worth keeping the following in mind. So the modern day courts of appeals as we have them came to us in 1891, right? And for the first 100 or so years, those courts were expanded basically every decade with the exception of one decade early on, right? And that all stopped in 1990. So in the last 30 years, we have not received any new judgeships on those courts, despite the fact that the caseloads have continued to rise. So again, just to kind of take one like point in time, in 1990, we had something on the order of about 240 or so appeals per judgeship, right, per year. That's actually grown between 15 and 20% if we look to where we are today. So even if we were to hold politics aside, just thinking about the health of the courts, we should be seeing some expansion. And I think that's a promising place to start. Now we can talk about a little bit later. I think there's some difficult questions about how you actually go about expanding the courts. The Ninth Circuit is the clear elephant in the room. What happens when you start just adding seats to courts that are already quite big? But overall, I think there's a very strong argument, one that I think the public would find sympathetic about why we need to be adding some seats to that court.
So Molly, I think there's sort of this perception that, well, Democrats control the Senate and the White House and the House. And so this is all just a question of political will and maybe like, keeping Joe Manchin in line. And that's sort of all there is to it. But how different is a 50-50 Senate majority from a 49-51 majority? And, sort of are these reforms sort of all just going to be substantive legislation with Kamala Harris casting a lot of tie-breaking votes? Or are the Democrats going to be significantly hemmed in by the current formulation of the power sharing agreement in this Congress and in this Senate?
Yeah, so at present, the biggest obstacle to any kind of real legislative action in the Senate on court reform and a whole host of other things is the persistence of the Senate filibuster. And so we can have a discussion about whether we think the Senate filibuster for legislation is still going to be around in 6 months, in 3 months, in 3 weeks. But basically, at this point, any of the sort of, well, yes, to actually end debate on confirming federal judges only requires a simple majority. The kinds of proposals that would need legislative action that we're talking about, those still would need to overcome the threat of a filibuster. So there we're talking about 60, not just 50. So I think for me, a big question, and it's really tied up in, you know, what's happening really as we speak in the Senate, is if the Senate does choose to eliminate the legislative filibuster, what's really the precipitating issue that drives them to do so? It could be any of the court reform type proposals that we're talking about. It frankly could end up being the Senate's organizing resolution, which the Senate is currently tied in knots over. It could be a whole host of other things that President Biden and the Democrats have identified as their top agenda item. But if the filibuster goes away for legislation, and there is an issue that kind of drives the breaking of the dam, there are lots of other things, including, I think, potentially some of the kinds of proposals that we're talking about today that are back further up the river that would flow through differently downriver once the dam is gone, even if they themselves are not the thing that breaks the dam. And so I think as we kind of try to assess where we are right now, where we're going to be in 3 weeks, where we're going to be in 3 months, we have to kind of ask ourselves, where are the politics of lots of different things for this really narrow Democratic Senate majority, not just the politics of this issue?
So Dan, then President-elect, now President Biden, sort of in the days immediately before the election, when calls for court packing were sort of reaching a fever pitch immediately after Justice Barrett's confirmation, sort of made this announcement that he was going to have a commission to study reforms to the federal judiciary, and reportedly that commission will soon be announced, sort of its membership and its mandate. What do you anticipate an agenda is going to look like? Is this, really just about, two or three small handful of reforms, and it really does ultimately come down to kind of the procedural issues that Molly has addressed, the politics of it, or should we expect the commission to like really, really study these questions, come up with some novel solution? Kind of what's your expectation about what their agenda is going to look like?
Well, I think we don't totally know what to expect from the commission yet, because we don't actually really know why the commission is being created. Because when these questions were coming up, I thought Biden, I thought it was a pretty good feint to sort of get the issue off the table and sort of kick the can down the road in a way that didn't really necessarily alienate anyone. But there was a question, which is, does Biden actually want to do anything about the problem of the courts, or is it just not his priority? And I guess what the commission looks like, what its specific charge is, what its timeline is, what its membership is, so forth, is maybe going to tell us a fair bit about whether the goal of this commission is to go out there and come back with some really significant and possibly, progressive reforms that could really make a difference to the court, or whether it's something that's going to sort of spend kind of a long time, produce a long report, and then produce something that's kind of a wishy-washy recommendation in favor of term limits, which I think is probably if you had to just guess ex ante, and given that my understanding is that they're trying to assemble a bipartisan commission, that strikes me as ex ante the most likely thing that the commission would come up with. Will it be tasked with looking at the lower courts? I don't know. I'm very, very eagerly awaiting, more news about the commission so we can figure out really what to expect from it. Because I think that what we hear early on is going to tell us a lot about what we can expect later.
So, Maureen, this isn't the first time that there's been commissions around court reform. And, right, so looking at the history here and trying to read the tea leaves of, is this just sort of an elegant punt to, put a hard problem somewhere beyond the date of the election, or if this is a genuine way to get really kind of thoughtful reform done? Sort of, have past commissions worked? Have they driven real change? And is there a reason based on the history to be optimistic about this one?
Yes, you're absolutely right, Susan. This is not our first commission rodeo, right? One way to think about it. So if you look over the last 50 years, we actually have this really healthy tradition of forming commissions, study groups, various committees, all aimed at studying either the Supreme Court or the federal judiciary as a whole. So just to give you a couple quick examples, you know, in the 1970s, we got the Commission on the Revision of the Federal Court Appellate System. This is famously the Hruska Commission. We get the Federal Court Study Committee in the 1980s. We get the Commission on Structural Alternatives for the Federal Courts of Appeals. That was the White Commission in the 1990s. So one way to understand what we're seeing here is simply picking right back up with that tradition. And I think there is a real value in bringing together scholars, judges, lawmakers, court administrators generally, and thinking about the health of the federal judiciary and where we may need reform. So, you know, holding aside the fact this may be a punt, I think as a more general matter, it's a good thing that we have a study of the courts. Now, to your question about how successful these commissions have been, the evidence points in both directions. So if we go back to the Hruska Commission, one of their major reform proposals was that we split the Fifth Circuit. And this was just because the court was getting so large at the time. And that, in fact, happened a few years later. So, you know, as folks will know, the Fifth Circuit was divided into what we now see as the Fifth Circuit, but then the 11th Circuit in 1981. Right. So that happened. So that's some good evidence that, you know, folks were listening. That said, that same commission also suggested that we get something called the National Court of Appeals. So they were creating a fourth tier within our judicial hierarchy. So this was a court that was supposed to sit between the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court, and it would help resolve circuit splits. Now, obviously, we don't really talk about the National Court of Appeals today because it does not exist, right? So despite the fact that this was one of the prominent recommendations of that commission, it didn't go anywhere, in large part because it failed to garner support from the judiciary itself. So I would say overall, I actually think it's a good thing that we have these commissions. I actually wish that we saw more of them. But whether or not it's going to translate into meaningful change, you know, as Dan said, I think the verdict is out.
Chris, Demand Justice has been pretty forward-leaning on calling for specific reforms. What are you looking for in a commission? Are you, right, is there membership? Is there issues? Sort of what are going to be the early indicators that that from your perspective, this is a serious effort and not a punt? And are you concerned about sort of losing the political momentum, whether or not, however well-intentioned it might be, you know, that to the extent that Barrett's confirmation was a catalyzing event, that the longer we move away from that and the longer that all presidents move away from the beginning of their terms, that it becomes harder to sort of get things done. So sort of what's your assessment of the commission and how promising do you think it'll be?
I think the most important question is going to be on the composition of the commission. Are these commissioners going to be people who are committed to reform, or is this, you know, is the commission's first step going to have to be to debate whether or not reform is even necessary? I'd like to see somebody like Attorney General Holder on this commission. That would give me a little more confidence about the direction it would turn in. I also think that it has to be a commission that includes people beyond academics. Like, look, some of my favorite co-panelists here are academics, but like, I think there need to be other people on this panel. I myself would love to serve on the panel. I think we have to have people that represent different aspects of the movement for court reform or who represent constituencies that have been affected by this overly partisan Supreme Court and whether or not those voices are in the room. Like, I think that's incredibly important. We certainly had a moment of momentum in response to Justice Barrett's confirmation. And certainly that sort of initial anger is starting to subside over time. But I'm quite confident, unfortunately, that this partisan political Supreme Court is going to have plenty of opportunities down the line, whether it's gutting the Voting Rights Act, whether it's considering whether or not climate change suits can move forward, whether it's challenging all of these executive actions that President Biden has taken. He's just had a raft of executive actions, and you already have attorney generals like Ken Paxton in Texas saying, I'm going to challenge him in court. What is this Supreme Court going to do to all of these affirmative policies that President Biden has taken? There's already a suit in Texas on the future of DACA, notwithstanding the fact that President Biden has reinstated it. What's the Supreme Court going to do at the end of the day? Unfortunately, this Supreme Court has shown that time and time again, it rules against people of color, against women, against equality, against justice. And that anger is going to come back, and it's going to come back in a vengeance. And the question then is whether this commission has adequately set the table so that Congress can then react in order to reform the court after these decisions come down.
So Dan, do you buy this prediction, right, that the political momentum is going to gain speed and reinforce itself as a conservative court strikes down sort of progressive executive action or progressive legislation? Or do you see the court protecting itself, right? Is this the kind of thing, the sort of the FDR threat model and might incentivize more sort of moderate rulings? How do you think it plays out in practice?
So I think it's something in between those two possibilities. I very much share Chris's view that there will be more drive for reform depending on what the court does. The thing I fear is not necessarily that the court is going to moderate that much, although there is some historical precedent for the court not going in as extreme a direction as people predicted. But instead, what I'm more worried about is the court slow playing things. You know, the court is aware of politics. They're looking at, you know, who's in power. And it may be that there are things lined up that some of the justices want to do. But maybe they wait to do that until after the midterm elections, when there's a possibility that Democrats lose control of the Senate and any chance of reform in the next 2 years becomes less realistic. And, you know, I don't think all the justices necessarily consciously make those kind of strategic considerations, but I think that there's some reason to suspect that some do, and that some in prior points in history have, that they kind of just wait, bide their time, wait for the right moment. And so I think it just depends what we see. I think if the court were to say, you know, strike down Roe versus Wade in the next year, the entire politics of this issue looks radically different. But also a lot of what the court does that people who know find so problematic are kinds of things that the public doesn't necessarily know about or really understand. I mean, things like the arbitration cases, which are not, you know, constitutional law, but they're interpreting the law in a way to make it really hard for consumers to sue. It's really hard to explain that to people, and they don't always understand it. And so that's another thing to be concerned about, is that some of the things we're most troubled about aren't the hot button things that really get people angry, though I expect there will be some of those as well.
I mean, Melanie, what is the legislative politics of this at the moment? So we've seen, right, as you mentioned, this is kind of all tied up in filibuster reform, sort of trying to read the tea leaves across the Senate. Is this a place in which there is any reasonable hope for bipartisan support or support among Republicans, you know, for reforms that at least in the short term are going to inure to the benefit of Democrats? Or are there a few sort of centrist moderates or you know, those senators that happen to have a pet issue that they care about and are willing to break party with? Sort of in just setting the political expectations, is there any reason to believe that the polarization that has driven some of these trends thus far isn't going to sort of continue in being opposed to reforms?
So I think there are two questions implicit in what you're asking. One is, what would a coalition of people who wanted to actually vote for some court reform proposals look like? Given the recent history of Senate Republicans on judicial confirmation specifically, I find it difficult to imagine that any, certainly not 10 of them, would cross the aisle to do something that looks like expanding the power of Democrats over the federal judiciary. You know, if we know one thing about the Senate Republican Conference, as led by now Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, is that they're singularly focused on shaping the federal bench in favor of conservative judges over the long term. And so I think that as kind of an issue, it's hard for me to imagine getting bipartisan support for something that, again, looks like it's helping the Democrats shape the landscape of the federal court. I also think that there are some Democrats who could be skittish on some of these ideas as well. The second question is, in a world sort of post-legislative filibuster world that I described earlier, kind of where would some of these ideas rank in relative priority to other things that Democrats care about trying to do? So even if we don't think that court reform is the issue that breaks the dam, if we think it's one of the things that's further upriver, what are the other things that are also further upriver that a post-filibuster democratically controlled Senate would really try to act on? And I don't have a great sense of kind of where this ranks in relation to other issues. But I think that as we think about the prospects for legislative action on some of these issues, like that's a really important question to me. It looks like maybe Chris has something to say on that. So
well, I was just gonna say, like, I think that this is all same part of the same conversation, right? Like when you look at really, I think of the filibuster reform as essential to democracy reform, sort of enacting both pro-democracy policies like the Voting Rights Act and campaign finance reform, but also issues that are politically popular, sort of have broad, small d democratic support. And when you think about what might break the filibuster, whether it's a $15 minimum wage or voting rights or climate change legislation, you sort of break the filibuster for that, you pass those pieces of legislation, and then you have court reform has to be at the back end of that, because again, you have this 6-3 court, where I agree with Dan, not everything's gonna be struck down by this court, but bear in mind, Brett Kavanaugh is gonna be the swing justice now. So legislation's gonna rise and fall by Brett Kavanaugh's determination. And so if you're the Senate, you're the Democratic Senate, you go through the trouble of breaking the filibuster, passing the John Lewis Voting Rights Restoration Act, you're not going to leave it to this Supreme Court to uphold that legislation. And so I don't know if court reform comes immediately after or a little bit down the road, but I think the entire debate and the entire tenor of the conversation has to be seen as a theory of change that starts with getting rid of this racist filibuster and ends with having a Supreme Court that's going to be legitimate and that will uphold these laws at the end of the day.
So we're going to lose Dan at 2, but there are a few, there's a lot of audience questions and a few that I want to make sure we've given Dan a chance to weigh in on before he has to go teach his own students at 2 o'clock. So I'm going to switch to some audience questions and read them out, and I'll let you guys sort of weigh in as you'd like. So this first one is, do you feel the method of selecting justices and other federal judges meets our needs, or would you prefer a different appointment system, for example, an independent nominating commission as used in several states? So a reform that isn't high on the list of sort of public awareness, but sort of, do any of you have thoughts on that kind of model?
Sure, I'll jump in just for a quick moment. I think in some ways this goes back to a point that Dan had made earlier, which is, you know, we have to think about what problems we're trying to solve. And a commission model actually solves a few different problems, right? I think it might well help with legitimacy, the perceived legitimacy of these courts. If you have a sense that, you know, lay people, for example, got to help select, at least come up with a list that the president would choose from. And I think it also could solve the diversity problem. So one clear example we have here comes from the Carter era, right? So as we know, there was substantial court expansion under President Carter. And the way that he filled those seats was to have the Carter Commission. So he had individual panels for the circuit courts, and there were lawyers and non-lawyers alike who actually came together and took applications from folks out in the public and interviewed potential judges and then came up with a shortlist for Carter to choose from. And it's part of that process that then led us to get a much more diverse bench, certainly much more diverse in comparison to the nominees we've gotten from the previous administrations. So I think there actually is some promise to that. I don't think we're going to see it with the Supreme Court, but it's not impossible to think we could get it for the courts of appeals again.
I think it also depends on who sits on those commissions, right? I think that a lot of senators, for example, use independent commissions to help them make recommendations for courts. And as the People's Policy Project did a study last year, it showed the overwhelming number of people on those commissions are prosecutors and corporate law partners. And then, surprise, they recommend a lot of prosecutors and corporate law partners. And so we have a different problem. We talk a lot about diversity, and certainly there needs to be sort of demographic diversity with more women and people of color and LGBTQ judges on the bench. But there also need to be more public defenders and civil rights lawyers and legal aid lawyers and plaintiffs lawyers. And I think that those kind of people are the kinds of people that are shut out of the gating mechanisms, whether they're commissions or otherwise, and therefore set out of being on the court. And so one of the important things I think President Biden has done is he and his White House counsel have already told Senate Democrats, we need professional diversity. We need these underrepresented lawyers like public defenders and civil rights lawyers on the bench. And I think that will be an important indication of how seriously Democrats and other people broadly consider how diverse and how we consider diversity on our court. So I think I agree with Maren that, that commissions could be helpful, but it really depends on who sits on them and how diverse those commissions are from the beginning.
Dan, I'm not sure if you had a thought as well.
I was just going to say that I like them in principle. And I think that, you know, some of the states that have used those nominating commissions, it's worked out and they've gotten a reasonably strong judiciary. But I don't think it totally addresses the current situation we're in, where we have these increasingly polarized legal cultures. And we have no real consensus on what counts as expertise, where the center is. And I suspect that if we tried to install one of those in the same way that this sort of ABA used to serve that role, it would evaluate nominees and would, you know, say whether they're qualified or well qualified. It came under partisan attack by Republicans who sort of saw it as undermining their judicial nominees. And I would expect a similar thing to happen unless the commission was really, really divided along partisan lines, in which case it might kind of produce outcomes that look a lot like the ones we currently have.
So this is a little bit of a technical question, but it popped up a few times. And so asking if term limits were opposed, could they apply to the current justices? And sort of what would the mechanics of that look like? Dan, you mentioned that you thought that there was a sort of a constitutionally valid structure of rotation. Would that apply sort of to the currently confirmed justices?
Well, I mean, we're still in the kind of universe of, you know, who knows. I will say that most of the reforms that have been proposed to do this along with pure statutes have chosen to grandfather in existing justices. And for what it's worth, such a reform, such a, you know, provision might make that kind of reform more politically sellable because it sort of changes the future status quo, but doesn't sort of change the existing balance of power and the sort of hard-won victories that each side have. That said, you know, to the extent that that's the choice that's made, it then creates a situation where there's sort of unilateral disarmament. So Democrats would impose this and they'd say our nominees going forward are only going to serve 18-year terms. But, you know, Justices Barrett, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch are going to be on the court until 2060 or so. Again, I think that there are, my view is that there are ways that it could be done depending on exactly how the legislation was drafted. I'd say it's fair to say it's more controversial because you might say, well, you know, you are changing the terms of those justices' tenures. I don't think that's a slam dunk argument. I think there are counter arguments, but I think it might be sufficiently seen as much of a you know, if we even are willing to go down the term limits through statute path, people might be a little nervous about doing that.
So another question is, since many proposed reforms to the Supreme Court will likely end up before the Supreme Court itself, how receptive do we believe the Supreme Court might be to reforms? And I'll add a little bit of an addendum there, which is, can we expect the court to participate in this debate at all itself? So we've seen Chief Justice Roberts be quite uncomfortable sort of with his increasingly public role, for example, during the impeachment trials, plural at this point. So how might the court itself view this moment, and is there any expectation that beyond the instances in which they are compelled to rule on the precise merits, do we expect to hear anything from them in terms of participating in this conversation? I'll throw it out to anyone.
So maybe that'll still be my last word before I have to disappear to teach. So I think it depends. I think that, you know, first of all, this court is a very kind of formalist court. And I think that they would be, you know, in the abstract, this court would be very likely to buy the kind of formalist argument that this is not consistent. Any kind of term limits, reforms like that are not consistent with the terms of the Constitution and the Good Behavior Clause. That said, I do think at least some of the justices are aware of where things stand politically and are a little concerned about getting too far out in front of their skis. And it would be the case that in a situation like this, to the extent the court is asked to rule on a reform that affects itself, it doesn't look amazing for the court to say, you know, yes, we're, you know, extending our tenure, even though the political system thinks that it shouldn't. And I do think that, you know, the underlying politics, not just of when the reform is passed, but the underlying politics of the moment when the reform and the challenge comes to the court matter. And so I think doing what is necessary, not just, you know, to get a law passed, but to kind of build public support for it, strikes me as really, really important.
So with that, Dan, we will let you go, and then we'll spend the last 15 minutes just, you know, beating up on all of your ideas when you aren't here to defend yourself. Just kidding, we will not do that.
I would follow on Dan's point, not to contradict him as he's left, but I do think that I do think the one thing about adding seats to the Supreme Court is it is unquestionably constitutional, right? The Congress has changed the size of the Supreme Court 7 times. And so it's hard to imagine how even this Supreme Court could consider that as a question or possibly strike it down. But that said, in the debate more broadly, I think the other part of Supreme Court reform that we haven't talked about yet is ethics reform, right? The Supreme Court of the United States is the only court in the entire country that does not have a binding code of ethics. And you see time after time again, some of these Republican appointed justices abusing that. And so I could see them injecting themselves into these conversations and into these debates in a way that you wouldn't otherwise expect, because they understand that ethics rules don't apply to them, sort of whether calls comes to calls for their recusal or whether they're meeting with people who are sort of amicus or parties in the case, sort of outside of the contours of the case, or see time and time again these little things popping up, that I think that that's another aspect of reform we have to be cognizant of and be considerate of.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
I was just going to jump in to say one other quick point. I mean, you know, I think one thing that's so interesting about these discussions of court reform is, right, for the most part, we expect judges to be silent on these matters, right? And so this creates an interesting dynamic. So from time to time, you'll see retired judges weighing in on certain matters. So we saw that, of course, with the confirmation process of Justice Barrett. A number of former judges said that they thought this was being done in haste and should be put off. And they were criticized for entering into the fray. But there is this kind of interesting void, because for the most part, we don't expect sitting judges and justices to be vocal about these issues. And I certainly think that we'll see that to be true with Chief Justice Roberts. I mean, as we all know, he has made it a point to try to be as apolitical as possible in his presentment, you know, that we don't have Obama judges, we don't have Trump judges. I think the last thing he's going to want to do is to make it seem as if he's taking a political position. But that said, I think this is to Chris's point, you know, that's not true for all of them. And there are some justices, of course, who have, you know, said a little bit more. Justice Alito, of course, spoke out with the Federalist Society not too long ago and said some things that were political in nature. That was how they were taken. So we may see some of the justices, you know, giving some indication of their views on these matters. So I don't think we'll see it from the chief.
And one, I just started that one additional, I think, peculiarity of this moment is sort of the phenomenon of the celebrity justice. So certainly we saw this around Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but also I think I saw a throw pillow with Neil Gorsuch's face stitched on it. Amy Coney Barrett's, the dogma lives loudly within you mugs, right? So sort of both sides, sort of across the political spectrum, this real rush to, sort of create almost a brand and a celebrity around the justices themselves. And as you mentioned, Justice Alito is feeling more comfortable leaning into sort of partisan rhetoric of this moment. And so also thinking about kind of the background conditions. So another question, Molly spoke about the process once lower court nominations are made, committee approval, simple majority vote, vacancy of the blue slip process. At the earliest stage of this process, how are nominees identified and nominated, and how, if at all, have changes in this stage of the process impacted the judiciary and the confirmation process? Are there any potential reforms in this early stage, bipartisan selection, outsourcing nomination to independent bodies, et cetera, that might help decrease the appointment of extreme ideologues? So either Molly or Chris, you know, sort of are there sort of in the very early sort of pre-selection stage or selection stage, is there opportunities for reform there?
So reform may be a relative term. I think one of the biggest challenges here with lower court nominations is that home state senators still play a dominant role, in particular on the district courts. So far, blue slips still are honored, which I think is a mistake. I think it is a mistake to let Ted Cruz have veto power over President Biden's judges in Texas, or to let Josh Hawley have veto power over judges anywhere. Right, I think there's a problem here with the way the system is, but because of that, it drives you to let these individual senators, so there are 50 different processes across 50 states, where some states, each senator has their own process. And so it's hard to then come up with a broad set of reforms that might be applicable. I think that the one thing that President Biden, again, done very well early on was when his White House counsel sent that letter to Senate Democrats and said, give us names faster, because one of the huge problems in delay of President Obama's nominees was waiting for senators, and two, make sure that they're diverse, that they sort of reflect the diversity of our country and the diversity of our legal profession. And I think that just setting, having the president set out his priorities very clearly from the outset makes a huge difference. It certainly was a big driver when President Obama made clear he wanted to have a judiciary that looked like our country, sort of demographically diverse. We started to see a lot more women and people of color and LGBTQ nominees and candidates sort of raising their hands to be considered for the first time in that court or in that state's history. And I think that President Biden is setting that tone and direction right now. And I think that may be as important as anything in terms of how we change what kind of nominees come out through this process.
And Chris, sort of looking back over the 4 years of the Trump presidency and the blue slip process, are there instances in which you, in which the blue slip process prevented unqualified people from coming forward to a vote? Right. So is it whenever we think about sort of loosening the constraints and it applying equally to both sides, has the blue slip process played any role in the Trump era, or a meaningful role, such that the next time there might be a president that doesn't align with sort of your progressive views, you'll regret to have seen it gone?
Well, I won't regret to have seen it gone, in part because, again, there's this asymmetry in which Republicans during the Obama administration were far more difficult with their blue slips and sort of what it would take to reach compromise than Democrats would. And so, for example, Senators Durbin and Duckworth recommended a couple judges from Illinois who were opposed by the reproductive justice and civil rights community, but they still sort of, in an effort to find consensus, returned their blue slips on those nominees. Now, Senator Duckworth voted against them at the end of the day, but with the Republican Senate, they were still confirmed. Right. You don't have very many instances of that, if any, really, in the Obama administration. And so clearly there were some Democratic senators who used their blue slips. And the only reason why we have any judicial vacancies now are because senators like Senators Booker and Menendez and Warren and Murray and Schumer and Feinstein used their blue slips, and Harris used their blue slips to leave some of these seats open. So there are probably about 36 district court vacancies to be held open. But that also shouldn't be the incentive structure in which you end up with these courts, right? Like where backlogs are being driven up higher and higher because you can't reach consensus. And so I think in the long run, getting rid of blue slips, even if it means a Republican president can get more conservative nominees in, because Republican senators already play that game and Democrats don't, I still think in the long run, it's going to be to the progressive court's benefit.
I just want to add a couple observations around a couple things that Chris mentioned, actually kind of where he left off his comments, which is the importance of sort of the supply of judicial vacancies, that it's not just kind of which types of prospective judges are being identified and how they're getting identified, but also how many vacancies are available for a given president and Senate to fill. And our Brookings colleague, Russ Wheeler, has done yeoman's work on this over time. And so I can tell you that when on Inauguration Day, Trump inherited vacancies in about 9% of the Court of Appeals seats, whereas Biden will inherit about 2%, same or similar disparities for district courts, that basically Trump inherited many more than Biden has. And that also gets to this point of, like, for a given Senate, which has competing priorities, where are they going to spend their time? And it's clear that during the Trump administration, for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is McConnell's very committed focus to filling the federal judiciary with conservative nominees, that's where the Republican-controlled Senate spent much of its time over the past 4 years. When we look ahead to a Democratically-controlled Senate with a Democrat in the White House, and we ask these questions about competing priorities, we have to, this Chris's point about sort of trying to get the nomination process and the confirmation process for judges such as vacancies exist moving really quickly, I think is a really important part of that as well, because we're not just talking about kind of who these nominees are, which is a really important conversation. We're also talking about how many of them, how many vacancies are available to fill, and what are the various pieces of the Senate schedule that need to be fit together.
And if I can just add one quick point to that, I think, so it's hugely important to think about, right, how many seats we have open right now, and worth considering that that number is going to grow. So just a point a number of folks have focused on in the last few weeks. At the Court of Appeals, for example, we have at this moment over 60 judges who are eligible to take senior status. That's like a kind of quasi-retirement. These judges then can continue to hear cases, but typically it's at a reduced load. And quite importantly, it then creates a vacancy for the president to fill. So again, over 60 of these judges, we're talking about roughly a third of the number of authorized judgeships that we have right now. I think there's good reason to think that quite a few of those judges, at least in the next 6 months, year and a half, are going to take senior status. And so that could really affect this dynamic as well.
And I'll also just add on that point, and because whenever we talk about how many vacancies Trump had in the beginning, it's because Mitch McConnell blocked them all, right? Mitch McConnell allowed the confirmation of only two circuit judges in a two-year period, which is the fewest since the 1800s. Right, so that's really the McConnell rule, he's made up many, is that Democratic presidents are never gonna get their judges confirmed on a Republican Senate. And so then when we look now at how many judges are senior eligible and the fact that we are at a 50-50 or 50-51 Senate, this is the time for Democratic appointed judges who are considering senior status, if they're considering whether or not the president who will oppose their successor, if that's an important factor to them, and I think it seems to be sort of historically an important factor that many judges consider, sort of now was the time to take senior status rather than waiting to see what happens sort of in 2022 to whether or not President Biden can fill your vacancy 2 years from now. I think that sort of the dynamics about when vacancies and how vacancies come up has completely shifted in that regard as well.
So sort of two questions I'll combine into one on sort of the case management aspects of this. So one, given the lengthy time it takes to litigate a federal civil appeal and given the brevity of time allowed for oral arguments, and when it's even granted, isn't there a justification for expanding the number of federal appellate judgeships? And relatedly, could expansion of the court increase its productivity, allowing for the acceptance of more cases overall?
So that's a great question. The answer is yes. I mean, I think there's a longer history here that complicates the picture. We were talking about the caseload at the courts of appeals rising quite dramatically over time. And in response to that, the courts of appeals as a whole adopted different case management strategies, right? So more and more cases then were sent to what we call a kind of non-argument track. So they didn't receive oral argument, or oral argument times ended up getting reduced across the board. We saw an increase in staff attorney offices. So, staff attorneys at the courts of appeals help to manage these cases as well and can play a pretty prominent role in making recommendations for how certain cases should be resolved. So, one thing, again, I think that complicates the story is today, I think some judges on the courts of appeals would say that they're doing fine overall in terms of keeping up with their workload, but that's in part because they've adopted these strategies over time. And I think something that would be really helpful for the Biden commission to consider is, are we happy with that status quo, or would we, as many have argued, be better off if we had more cases going to oral argument and so on? And that really would require more judge power at the end of the day.
Yeah, so I'll, I think we have time for one, maybe two more. And this is sort of a big one, but what is the role of court reform in helping to eradicate past racist practices in the judicial and criminal justice system? So obviously we're having a larger cultural and legal conversation about systemic racism, the prevalence of that in our court systems. Is that separate and apart from how we should be thinking about court reform, or is that a related conversation and maybe even the same conversation?
I definitely think that this conversation around court reform is also a conversation around democracy reform. It's also a conversation about economic justice, and it's also a conversation about racial equality. Where when you look at court reform and the substantive impacts it can have, whether it's on voting rights, whether it's on qualified immunity and police brutality, whether it's on issues like climate change and access to healthcare, which have a disproportionate impact on people of color, substantively, this conversation around court reform is going to impact people of color and lead to potentially greater racial equality. Also, we've talked a lot about the need for greater diversity on the court. President Biden has made clear that his next nominee for the Supreme Court is going to be a Black woman. The Supreme Court's never had a Black woman justice. Supreme Court's also never had an Asian American justice or a Native American justice. Sort of think about the ways in which you can use an expanded Supreme Court and expanded lower courts to expand the diversity of the courts. I think at the end of the day, for me, all of these court reform ideas, we talked about, like, what is the thing you're trying to solve for? I'm trying to solve for greater legitimacy of the courts, greater public confidence in the courts. Some of that is around the ideological makeup of it. But also, as you see, President Trump nominating the most white justices proportionally that we've seen in decades, reversing all of this progress. People of color are not going to have as much confidence in the courts when they don't see people literally that look like them reflecting the diversity of our nation there. That's an incredibly important reason to expand not just the Supreme Court, but the lower courts as well. And so I think it's a great question, and I'm really glad that we're starting to think about court reform sort of in such an expansive and important way.
So that just about brings us to the end of our time. So Marin, Chris, Molly, Dan, and Attorney General Holder in absentia, thanks so much for joining us today and kicking off this really important conversation.